The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
This is Steve Lord reading What Could Be by S. Julie Liu. My mother was from the sea, raised by the Pacific Ocean that laps at both China and the United States. When she rose, salt-crusted from that amniotic love, she found that she could never stay long on either shore, that she needed to be traveling between them. She was more jellyfish than person, her presence tentacled through my life. Yet at the same time, she was translucent, transparent. There one moment, gone the next. She was a yearning, a wish for a barnacled presence, rather than the slipstream glimpses I caught. In death, she became a dream, something unreal that couldn't exist on land the way I did. She slipped away from me until all I had were her ashes, scattering away from my hands into the Pacific. My mother was from the sea, and to the sea she returned, leaving me standing alone on one shore.
I'm Emily Chiola, and I will be reading That Electric Feel by Stephen Fisher. They told you the surgery would be painless, that you'd feel nothing as they sawed your skull open and wove your white matter full of copper wire, as the bundle of processors that they buried deep in your chest slowly integrated itself into the way you thought, the way you dreamed, the way you were. They didn't lie, but they didn't tell you that you'd feel nothing afterwards, too. That you wouldn't feel accomplished or proud as you look down at the glass of $100 bourbon in your hand. As you survey the posh nightclub you wouldn't have been allowed into only months ago. Or as the phone in your pocket buzzes for your attention, a message from another investor, no doubt. Worst of all, you don't even feel angry at them for making you so empty. It's in there somewhere. The emotion you should be feeling, but it's buried under so many layers of calculation and analysis that you hardly recognize it. It sounds more like someone shouting underneath the water than the crisp, clear voice in which your own thoughts used to speak. Instead, something strong, but cold, has replaced it. 67% of startups fail within the first year. Of the remaining 33%, only 27 ever turn a profit. Even when a company does everything right, even when their CEO and founder can make countless accurate calculations in the span of seconds, there will always be an element of chance. Because not even a computer in your brain lets you control consumer behavior. You knew all this before, of course, but it was easier to forget. That hopeful, naive voice inside your head somehow able to push it away. Thoughts like that used to make you feel nervous, but now you don't feel anything. Across the room, a woman is dancing alone. There are others on the dance floor, but she's the only one truly moving to the music. She twists and spins in perfect step, despite every error that you hear the swing band make. The trumpet, 3 hertz flat on 4 notes in one measure, 3 milliseconds late to enter on the next. She doesn't hear it, of course. No one else does. Despite it, she moves gracefully, and you almost forgive the band for their mistakes. Sharp, symmetric facial features, thin, athletic figure, long hair, long legs, and a dress cut almost to her hip. She's beautiful, objectively. The kind of woman you would have spent all night pining over before the surgery. Now, you just watch. As the music comes to a merciful halt, she walks toward the bar and takes the seat beside you. Up close, she seems somehow even more perfect. one of the few true winners of mankind's genetic lottery. One, maybe two folks in 1,000 gifted with the feature she has. I couldn't help but notice you staring, she says, with the slightest of smiles on her lips. But it looks forced, as if the gesture is more for your sake than her own. Your mind races, neurons and circuits firing in tandem. I wasn't staring, you mutter, in exactly the tone that is most likely to be received as apologetic and disarming. And you really weren't staring. You'd made certain of it. One glance every 15 seconds, the ideal interval to avoid the appearance of fixation. Fair enough, she replies, then motions to your glass. Are you at least going to buy me a drink? Beautiful and confident. You can only imagine how you would have stumbled over your words if you'd met her months ago. Thankfully, apathy has made you less awkward. Sure, why not? She flags down the bartender and orders a whiskey sour. You watch him pour the drink 2 milliliters short. She takes it from him and taps her glass against yours. Thanks, I appreciate it, even if the bastard poured it light. You're a whiskey fan, too. The reply is out of your mouth before you realize what she actually said. 2 milliliters. No one but you could have noticed something so small. You almost pass it off as a coincidence until you see that she's smiling again, for real this time. You watch her eyes move across your face. 10 degrees up, 5 degrees left, 8 degrees down, a perfectly normal search pattern. Far too perfect, in fact, to be anything close to normal. You replay the memory of her dancing in your mind, perfectly preserved thanks to nearly infinite storage, and you notice that she was looking at you, too. You'd missed it at first because it had been so subtle. Only once every few measures. Only once every 15 seconds. Her grin widens as you start to frown. What can I say? Great minds think alike, she says, running her fingers through the hair along the back of her neck. At the gesture, you can almost feel the wires beneath your own skin tingling. Or at least our programming does. She downs the glass and rises from the bar stool, reaching out to take your hand. Would you like to dance with me? The words catch a moment in your throat as a strange feeling spreads through your chest. Wires or heartbeat or both? You aren't certain, but you're certain you'd like that very much.
Hi, I'm Tom Atkinson, and I'm going to be reading Cracks in the Mirror Glass by Anna Marie Yates. I didn't miss the little house in the woods until it was gone, its stools carved to fit my stunted legs and its eaves lowered for my unnatural arms to fetch the dried apples down on a winter's night. Our king has lost his queen. He has ordered his forest cleared. His grief has become my own. The village is too large for me. Its stairs are too high, and the villagers long-limbed and smooth-faced. Hideous, the milkmaids call me. Dwarf woman, the tavern keep says. Rose Red, I tell them again and again, my name is Rose Red. My mother and I huddle in our filthy room, paid for in the potions she is teaching me to make. Her twisted arms hold me tight, our reflection in the mirror the only thing my mother brought from the little house, is kind and good. You're beautiful, she says. I believe her. The king and his little daughter will pass through the village in 3 days' time. My mother and I will beg him for our little house in the woods. The tavern keep wants an enchanted barrel that will never run dry. His slick leather boots reach up high as my chest when he bargains with my mother. He brings his daughter, a green-eyed beauty with red lips that frown at the sight of me. His daughter wants a love potion to serve the king. She would be the new queen. My mother shakes her head. Magic for self always ends poorly, she tells them both. The tavern keep will not accept this. He threatens and stomps his enormous feet, but my mother doesn't tremble. He spits on us. His daughter hesitates. I stare at the gob of spit on my mother's skirt. I beg her to make the barrel and potion. Perhaps the tavern keep's daughter will become queen and grant us our little house. The tavern keep rants. His daughter tells tales of the monstrous dwarves, half male, half female ghouls, who steal love from the unwitting and spin it into foul magic. My mother sends me to collect marigolds for a tonic. The baker's boy and his friends chase me down an alley. The tavern keep's daughter watches from the window above. She turns away when they beat me with a stick. Monster, the baker boy says. Die, his friends say. I cover my oversized head. Rose Red, I say. My name is Rose Red. When I stagger home, my mother is not there to comfort me. The mirror lies cracked on the floor. I collapse in our pallet of rags, pretending I hear her voice reminding me that I am beautiful. My shattered reflection shows me a bloody dwarf with a torn face. My mother does not come home, not that day, nor the next, nor any day after. The tavern keep laughs when I work up the courage to ask him. He sizes me up like a huntsman his prey. Better dead than like you. As I leave, his daughter whispers the foul things the village boys will do to my deformed corpse. Like your mother, she says. I flee, but my bandy legs are not fast enough, and my gait is a waddle instead of a run. Cracks slash my reflection in the broken mirror. I am not beautiful, no matter what my mother said. But I am Rose Red. My mother has taught me well, and our larder of ingredients is well stocked. But the enchantment is difficult. I curl up on the floor and rest, mirror clutched against my chest, for night and a day before I am strong enough to go on. You are beautiful, I tell the mirror. My face contorts into a withered mask, but the crackled glass heals. The mirror takes on the faintest sheen. My joints ache. I force one foot in front of the other. My back is crooked now, and my fingers curled into claws. I clutch the mirror to my chest. Dust on the horizon and flaring trumps announce that the king and his little daughter are nearing our village. I shuffle to the tavern. The tavern keep's daughter doesn't recognize me. She cringes from my toothless smile. Go away, old crone, she says. A gift for the future queen. With shaking arms, I hold out the mirror. The reflection of her glowing skin and red lips entrances her and draws her forward. The king's carriage rattles into sight. His little daughter sits upon his lap, hair black as coal, skin white as snow. She is a beautiful child. The tavern keep's daughter lifts her eyes to the king's as he passes. Mirror, mirror, I whisper, as I pass the mirror into the keeping of my enemy. Who is the fairest of them all? I am, the tavern keep's daughter says. The king's carriage draws to a stop. Yes, my queen, the mirror answers. For now, I whisper, the child is truly beautiful.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and I'll be reading Bitter Medicine by Erica L. Fatifka. The telltale heat signature lights up Foster's screen like a Roman candle. That one, she says, pointing at the blocky warehouse. Two interns peel off and barrel down the hill to where the second vehicle is parked behind a stand of trees. A few minutes later, Foster hears a muffled gunshot. The orange splotch on the screen slowly fades. Someone hands her binoculars. Take a look. Foster peers through the specs. Beyond the murky windows, she sees the interns making the usual preparations. Decontaminating the scene, bagging the body, taking pictures. One of them, Jeff, peels a length of skin off the wall. Should we go help them? I think they've got it covered. Below, Jeff slings sacks of already rotting shaper flesh onto the truck. The other member of the collection team gets into the driver's seat. They gun it up the hill and park near the van, and Foster starts putting her screen and other small items back in her bag. "We'll meet at the lab," she tells the driver before boarding with the others. Foster startles awake as they screech to a stop. She rubs her eyes, looking out at the drab medical plaza, which houses the Central California Cancer Research Lab. She stretches her arms, nearly smacking the man next to her in the face. "Sorry, guy," she says, but he's still dozing. The security checkpoint seems to take longer than usual, and Foster climbs out of the van to see what's up. Sure enough, it's a protester. Foster rolls her eyes. "The Shapers lost. We won. Get used to it." "We could have waited. Their blood is on our hands." The protester tugs at Foster's shirt. Foster circles around to glare at the woman, her hand bunching into a fist. "Do you want to get arrested? Do you? They gave us a wonderful gift and we killed them for it." The blood rushes to Foster's face. "Nobody wanted to kill them. But do you want to be the one who had to wait? Or your mom? Or your grandmom? They don't live that long. Or at least didn't," the protester spits back. She holds up a length of chain she's looped around her leg and the fence. "To hell with your dirty medicine!" "Get her off there," Foster snaps at the guard. He nods and brings out the bolt cutters. The chain snaps, the gate whines open, and the protester squeals as the guard drags her away. Foster walks alongside the truck, then helps carry the sacks to the basement. As the overhead fluorescents turn on, she gags a bit at the smell emanating through the Pyrex containers that line the walls. "Get it on the table," Foster says. Jeff and the others empty the sacks, and Foster splays out the organs and skin folds. "Whoa, this is a fresh one." Someone hands her a scalpel. "Had it spawned yet?" That was always hard to tell. 3 of the Shaper's 7 different sexes were involved in reproduction, and the immediate decay of their bodies upon death made identification nearly impossible. "If it did, we won't know for 7 years. And then we'll go out there," she thought, "shoot them and bag them and deliver the gift to the next group of patients." And so on and so on. "I hope so. There's a report from the Maryland lab that says reproduction is down among Shapers." "Or they've just gotten better at hiding," Foster says, snapping on her gloves. In addition to the special property of their flesh, Shapers could also take on the form of living creatures, usually humans. It had been a little boy who had whispered the formula for the chemical that cured cancer into a Harvard professor's ear. The heat signature, though, never lied. "Formaldehyde," Foster says, and Jeff the intern slips a sample vial into her hand. She delicately picks up the pieces of shattered Shaper and bottles them. "When do we send out the next batch?" "On Tuesday, I think. It'll be ripe by then." Jeff nods. "I'm heading home now." She waves at him and the others. "I'll be here a while. You all take off." Most do. Foster dissects the Shaper's head, removing its eyes and plopping them into separate vials. She hums as she works. When she looks down at the table, she startles. They really do look like us, she says to no one, examining the shaper's pinned face. And we killed them. Scrubbing her hands, she watches shaper blood run down the drain. They deserved to die. They knew our bodies well, but they didn't know our minds. They thought we'd be satisfied to wait for our cure until they died of natural causes. Foster laughs, thinking of that innocent face she'd just filed. Shaper should never have told humans that the cure for cancer was their own aged remains. Foster leaves the lab well after midnight. She orders a rideshare and waits near the guard station, one hand on the pepper spray in her purse. To her left, bushes rustle. I'm armed, she says, fearing another protester. It's a squirrel, fat for winter. The squirrel watches Foster with glossy black eyes, and she kneels down to look at it. Hey there, little guy. The critter approaches her cautiously on stubby legs. Foster smiles at it, but then it darts away, casting one look back at her. This time its eyes are sad, pained, and most of all, intelligent. Not the intelligence of a human, but something very close, if a little naive. You have gotten better at hiding. But what does that mean for us? The car pulls up, and Foster gets in, trembling.
I'm Kurt Benrood, and this is titled Yours, Not Mine, by Hamilton Perez. Demons have been coming to our home for some time now. At first it was terrifying, but now it's just a nuisance, like squat and scarified Jehovah's Witnesses. Charles was pretty rattled by it. He demanded an explanation and, having no one else to turn to, directed this demand at me. Maybe he looked to me because I just sort of took it in stride. It's not as if I was expecting this. I've just always been better at accepting things I don't have the power to change. I never begrudged Charles his reaction, though. They started coming just after we brought home Joshua, our little 4-pound tube of poop and giggles. New parents are often a little paranoid, whether justified or not, and the timing did raise some concerns for me as well. The demons were harmless, though. They didn't sneak in through basement windows, creeping up the stairs at night. They didn't hide in closets or under beds. They politely knocked at the door with offerings that, while repulsive, were clearly considered generous to demonkind. We received everything from cat skull baby rattles with the eyes and brain still inside to crocodile intestines tied into an almost beautiful demonic design. It was intended to be hung over the fireplace. They didn't speak English, of course. They didn't speak any human language, as far as I could tell, but I don't know anything other than English and no me gusta in Spanish, so it's hard to say. Charles didn't like their interest in Joshua. He hated how they mimed cradling a child with their thin, overly long arms. That's how they asked to see him. What could be the harm? These demons were the size of small children and only came in twos and threes. We might not get three wise men like Jesus, but three good-natured demons isn't something to snub your nose at. We moved twice, but somehow they always found us, bringing housewarming gifts that smelled like sulfur and decaying flesh. They probably were sulfur and decaying flesh. For Joshua, they brought a tiny crown made of bejeweled human finger bones and a caped onesie of sun-dried bat skin. Though grotesque, it was quite regal. Charles continued to demand an explanation.
How is this possible? How do they keep finding us? Well, they're demons, I said. Is it any stranger that they find us than that they exist at all? Charles didn't like this. He accused me of taking their side. We had a big fight about it, during which he accused me of fooling around, claiming that was the only explanation. Joshua didn't look anything like him after all. He couldn't be the father, he said, and it felt like something that had been hounding him, a dark suspicion following him wherever we went. I think he felt cheated when Joshua came out possessing all of my features and none of his. My long and slender limbs, my fiery blonde hair, my sharp nose, my wide-set green eyes. Charles then suggested that Joshua might be the result of some demonic version of the Immaculate Conception. Maybe we should just turn Joshua over to them. Though new to parenting, I understood that you stick to your kid through fire and flame. You protect them and help them thrive in whatever environment they're thrust in. Whatever Joshua was, he was beautiful and ours. In vain, I told him the truth. I hadn't been with anyone else. Joshua was his, ours, and we wouldn't give him up. You're wrong, he said. Charles stared at me in angry disbelief, his eyes saying, he's yours, not mine. Without another word, he walked out the door, disappeared entirely. The demons watched as he left and then looked at me with ugly, sympathetic faces. Without his support, I had to find a smaller place, one that I could afford on my own. Predictably, the demons followed. I found them tapping at the sliding glass door of our apartment. Quickly, I shut off the outside light and let them in. The last thing I needed was to be evicted for drawing the wrong kind of crowd. They waddled inside on their short legs, grumbled and gabbled in their strange tongue. The smallest of them, who was also the sweetest, offered me their gift while the other two went to watch Joshua sleep. They are silent as the grave when they wish to be. The gift was wrapped in discarded fast food wrap. Underneath was a human heart with a gash across the left ventricle. After an awkward thank you shouldn't have, I found tucked inside the gash two brown eyes, two familiar eyes that said, yours, not mine.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.